Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Mark Driver.
Hi, Chris.
Third show, hopefully. And up till now, we've been talking about what's happened in the last 4 years since I've been down here. And last week, we talked about various things, about the new barns and the new buildings and things. This year, I want to see what's going on, because one of the things about you, Mark, is that you're not going half-hearted. You know, it's like, I'm going to have a big business and I'm building infrastructure for a big business. And you've got all this big stuff, very little wine, but you've got all this infrastructure. So very shortly, you're going to have a lot of wine coming on stream. Are you fully planted yet?
No, we're not. So we're still, we planted about half of what we think we can eventually plant here at Rathfinney. So we've got about 180 acres. It's about just over 70 hectares of vines in the ground. And I think we can plant about another 60 to 70 hectares on this site. And then we're speaking to some of our neighbours and to look at planting vines elsewhere as well within the neighbourhood. Sort of 10 minutes by tractor. I quite like that, you know, the 10 minutes by tractor rule, which I don't know if you come across there. They're a vineyard on the Mornington Peninsula, and they have this rule that they will only buy grapes which are 10 minutes by tractor from their winery. Okay. So we're looking at land which is about 10 minutes by tractor from the winery here.
To buy or to?
To lease and to buy. It's very rare that farmers will sell you any land. Everybody wants to retain land. But we're looking at long-term leases where we're leasing land and planting vines, looking after the vines, managing the vineyards, and we're taking the produce and processing it at Rathfinney.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? So you're going to leak more land. You haven't even finished planting up, and you're
no. I think you have to look ahead. So you know, the reason we built infrastructure is that we had a business plan, which was a 10-year business plan. We could see what we were going to be able to plant out, and we could see. We could forecast the sort of production levels that we'd have over that 10-20 year period. So we built the resources to be able to process that. So the winery here is capable of processing and fermenting about 800,000 litres of wine, and the storage facilities for our wine on lees. We can hold about 4 million bottles in our on lease store. And so we're sort of building really for, you know, with that in mind. So, yes, it's built for a scale, but it's built really dependent upon the land that we had and what we think we can eventually grow to. Within 10 minutes, yeah. But it is about 10 miles, I'll say.
Is it?
Yeah, you know, we won't get any further than that.
Yeah, okay.
I have to have a fast tractor to get, you know, 10 miles away. But
what sort of time frame do you think it'll be before you're fully planted here first?
We've got some more planting going on next year and the year after. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be just infilling certain other slopes as well. But I think within the next 5 years, we will have planted out the whole of the our site here at Rathfinney.
Okay. Sorry, how long?
About the next 5 years. So
5 years?
Yeah.
Okay. And that 5 years plus 4 years for the wines to come good, so which means that within about another 8 to 10 years, you should be at full production.
Yeah, typically vines typically take about 5 years in order to get up to, you know, a reasonable yield, sort of 5 or 6 years. So, yeah, we're really looking about 10 years or so, 10 years' time, then we'll be up to pretty much up to our scale.
And next year should be a pretty big crop. 2018 should be a decent sized crop.
Yeah.
How many bottles do you think you'll produce 2018?
Well, you know, it depends on the weather. you know, we're
in a good year.
We're at the mercy of the weather. But yeah, assuming we get a good year, then I would have thought, you know, in early 19 we'll be bottling about 200,000 bottles.
200,000. Okay, so that's not too bad. So 200,000 is probably able for the domestic market to consume that, I would have thought. Is that, do you think?
Yeah, I think there are several English wine producers who are producing a similar scale and predominantly selling that into...
Who's that? Like Ridgeview, is it? Or?
Yeah, so people like Ridgeview, you know, Camel Valley, and the like are producing similar sort of volumes of sparkling wine, Chapel Down, etc., producing similar sort of volumes of sparkling wine and selling that domestically. But we're really looking at overseas markets as well. So for the last 3 years, we've been speaking to people overseas, speaking to distributors in North America, in Asia, in parts of Europe as well. So looking to develop those markets steadily, you know, one by one, slowly, slowly over the next 2-3 years. And, you know, we're quite confident that we've found somebody in Asia, so, you know, as a good distributor for our wines. And, you know, we're going to build from that. Hopefully next year we'll sign with a North American distributor. And then we'll build from there.
But your volume next year will be quite low. You won't have much product for them to have?
No. So we're releasing a total next year. It's about 11,000 bottles.
Yeah.
So that's reserved predominantly for the English market.
About, I would have thought just almost Alfriston.
Well, it could be, but we're, the bulk of that is actually going into London. So we've started signing and agreeing terms with certain restaurants and hotel groups in London.
Oh, you're dealing with them directly, not through...
through our agent. Also. Yeah, through our agent. Gonzalez Bias.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... So GB UK are handling all our distribution in the UK, and overseas we're speaking to others. So we got some wine going into Hong Kong next year, and the following year into Japan, and then North America.
Okay, all right. That's so very small volumes, though. It mustn't be.
Yeah. So it's small volumes, but our production the following year sort of grows to 30,000 bottles. The following year after that, it's over 100,000 bottles. So we need to develop these markets steadily over the next 3 years to be able to place the, you know, the increased volumes into markets, which we start to feed with smaller volumes, start to get the name out there, the brand out there, and so that then when the larger volumes come through, then we've got a ready-made market for it.
Yeah, okay, because a lot of the producers that I speak to really started with the domestic market. They weren't really looking overseas until the last couple of years, really, more than anything else. So you're actually looking to go out in all directions quite quickly. That's an expensive approach, isn't it? Because if you focus on one market, you can really focus in on that one market and all your marketing budget goes into that one market, whereas trying to do a lot of markets at once means your marketing budget is a little bit thinner everywhere.
So therefore, you have to, you have to invest money in that. But my belief is that the investment will pay back in quite a short period of time. There's a good market for our wines starting to open up overseas. So you have to do the travel. You have to go and find the right people to work with. We'll have to go around and do some training and telling people and training people, getting the press on side in all these new markets, etc. Getting the press over here to come and visit. See what we're doing here. But the markets are starting to open up. So there's a real buzz about English sparkling wine, for example, in parts of America at the moment. You may have read that some of our English wine producers have been winning awards in the Texas Sommelier Awards. So for really, really top American wine, domestic wine awards for best sparkling wines. So I know Ridgeview did very well there, and a couple of others have done quite well in these Texas Sommelier Awards. Others are doing quite well in competitions in other parts of the world, so in Asia, in Japan, etc. So there's a real buzz about English sparkling wine. It's the name is getting out there. The press coverage, which is we've had in the UK, has gone overseas. So I was in Hong Kong a few weeks ago. They were starting to talk about 3 years ago when I was there. It was just like no one's heard about English sparkling wine. Now everyone started to hear about it. They're really interested, and we got a good family connection in Hong Kong. So it's a great market to start with for us.
Some of the wineries like Ridgeview do they do a lot of winemaking for other people. They do contractual winemaking effectively. You're not going to go down that route, or are you going to go down that route, or is it all just everything's Rathfinney? Or I'm just trying to tease out the nuances of your business model.
Yeah, no, we'll just make wine for ourselves. So we'll just make Rathfinney wines. No, so there's no plan of making wines for anybody else.
Why is that?
Well, I think if you control the process all the way through, so, you know, we're using all of our own grapes from our own site, and we're processing those on site. It means that you get a greater control over the quality of the fruit that you've got. In year one, we brought in a little bit of fruit from another producer in Sussex, really just to test out the press, because we hated to fill a press. But, you know, we'd be using all our own fruit. And from our own site, so we got greater control. And then, you know, we know the brand, we know the quality, we know what we're doing. You know, we're not making wines for other people. You know, for others it works. Some it was partly because some of them got grants to buy equipment, and they had to open up for third party producers. Others, it's part of their business model. It helps fill their winery, keep them busy. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly in the early years, that's worked for them. We decided that we wanted to just process our own fruit, make our own wines.
A lot of wineries are buying in Bacchus, because Suffolk seems to be the place for Bacchus these days, not Suffolk, Norwich. Everybody seems to be gravitating towards that sort of grape variety.
Essex and, and Suffolk.
Yeah. And even a little bit further north a wee bit. But you're not interested in that?
Bacchus is very popular. I just don't feel that it's sustainable in larger quantities, so more commercial quantities of it's very difficult to actually reach the price point which makes you competitive with other still white wines. Mm-hmm. So my belief is that the future for English wine, certainly for the foreseeable future, is in sparkling wine, because that's what, you know, we produce fantastic grapes which are ideal for making sparkling wine. They've got great acidity levels, they've got quite low alcohol, relatively low alcohol levels, great acidity, perfect for making sparkling wine. Bacchus is fine. I'm not necessarily a great fan.
I was just wondering, because I thought, given that you're one of the problems for your marketing position is the lack of wine, you could buy some grapes and produce some still wines pretty quickly and therefore start the branding process earlier. But that's not really the path.
No, there have been some who've been buying in grapes from elsewhere. So buying in grapes from parts of Spain or France or elsewhere. And you could buy those in and you could make a British wine as such. Again, that's not part of our business model. We're focused very much on producing sparkling wine, really high quality sparkling wine. That's what all our effort, all our investment's going into. The little bits of still wine that we've made are really for the local market. They're allowing people to be able to taste a little bit of wine. So it's been a bit frustrating for people who've come along to visit visit Rathfinney over the last 3 years. They've had nothing to taste. So we had a little bit of still wine until the sparkling's available. So from next year on, we'll have the sparkling, and that's going to be the real focus of what we're doing.
Okay. So we've talked about domestic market. We've talked about how your volume's coming up. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about international, which you seem to be almost running everything in parallel. That does seem to be what you do. You just do everything in parallel at the same time, as opposed to what I would do, which is more incremental. I suppose that's why you're the entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think what we're looking at is 5 years' time, we're going to have reasonable volumes of wine, and therefore we have to create the market for that wine. So you can't just sit back and think that a market is going to suddenly open up for you. So we have to go out and we have to. Go out and create the noise. Talk about what we're doing. Talk about our wine making ethos. Talk about, you know, how we make our wine. Bring people down here. Show people around. Get people to start to taste some of our wine in tank or some of the wines which are prior to blending, so that they can start to see the quality of the wines that are coming out of Ralph Finney. So we've been doing that steadily over the last 9 months. It's proved really, really popular. We've got lots of people in London now who are, and the southeast who are, you know, big fans of what we're doing and very excited about the wines coming through.
What sort of price point are you going to go for? Because on the one hand, you've got someone like Ridgeview who go for what I think is quite a fair, you know, fairly decent price in terms of their positioning of their wines. And then you've got Hush Heath, which are almost the other end of the pricing spectrum as well. Where do you see your sort of your classic cuvée, which I imagine is your volume, entry-level, sparkling wine type of thing? Do you know roughly what price point you're looking for at the moment?
Yeah, I think you have to price it for the market. You know, at the moment, the market is, we're at the lower end of champagne-type prices. Mm-hmm. Which I think is probably where English wine is probably should sit.
When
at
you
the
say
moment.
Low end of champagne, because you can buy champagne at Tesco's for about £12 a bottle, or you can buy spend a bit more. So where is the low?
We're at the quality end of the spectrum. So we're not producing mass produced champagne, which is being sold out of cellar, normally from Soulat stock. Somebody's bottled up with some fake name on and shoved into and bulk shipped and sold out at a low price. No, we're not making that sort of wine. We're making a wine which is aged. It's typically our wines are aged for in excess of 3 years. You know, this is Grand Marc type pricing. So we are, you know, we're at the premium end of the champagne market. And we're selling at the lower end of champagne pricing. So if anything, English wine, sparkling wine, is, in a lot of respects, is actually really good value. It's typically, it's vintage, so it's coming predominantly from 1 year. It's not blended from various other years, which hopefully give you an extra smooth things out. This is vintage wine, and it's aged for longer periods of time. So, you know, our wine being aged for 3 years puts us at Grand Marc type aging. So therefore, we're priced at that sort of price level.
Which is?
Well, you're trying to get a price out of me, and I'm not going to give
a range.
I'm not going to give you a price. It's you have to wait until next year. The thing is, we're not releasing our classic cuvée. It was only bottled this year, so it won't be released until 2020. Mm-hmm. And who knows where the market will be in 3 years' time? So the Blanc de Blanc will be priced at around the sort of the same price as a lot of other English Blanc de Blancs at the moment. For a Blanc de Blanc, it's higher. So this is 100% Chardonnay. It's a really good wine. So it's you know, a good classic Blanc de Blanc. If you're talking about a champagne, will be priced at between 50, 60, 70 pounds, and we're obviously at a discount to that. So it's, you know, it's going to be priced at what I think is a fair price for the quality of the wine.
Okay. We'll find out what that is then. Okay. Just before we close up, Mark, you had your team in. We talked about the Flint Barn earlier, about how the pickers came in and stayed. A lot of people have been using gangs of pickers. In fact, there's a couple of big organisations now that supply vineyard workers who are quite trained up. You've gone for local people to run it. I interviewed Aubrey Vineyards,
yes.
Right beside the people who make your gin at Silent Paul. Yeah. And he uses gangs because he reckons that the locals just aren't interested in working in a vineyard because it's too cold and hard work. Yeah. But you've got locals in doing a lot of your work as well during the picking season, didn't you?
Yeah. And we had, about 120 people who turned up and picked our grapes for 2.5 weeks. On the first day, it was wet and I thought, well, they're not going to come back tomorrow. And in fact, we had more people come back the second day. And they stayed. The vast majority of those people stayed for the whole of the 2.5 weeks. Most of them were local. As I said, a few, we had about 20 people who stayed at the Flint Barns. And they came from all over the place, all over the UK and some from overseas. Yeah, I was really surprised, pleasantly surprised, that we managed to get a group of local people come in and pick grapes. It defied an awful lot of expectations. Everybody told me, you'll never get English people to pick fruit. They won't pick grapes. But we got 120 people a day to come in and pick grapes. And most of them loved it. They loved it. They really enjoyed it. Most of them had come from different careers. They've been doing different things. Some of them took it as holiday from their day job, and then they came and picked grapes for a week or two. Others, this was, you know, they were out of college or they were retirees. But we had a whole range of ages from 18 to 80 picking grapes. But they loved it and they really enjoyed it. And the vast majority of them said they want to come back next year. A large number of them said they want to come and help us do some pruning over the winter. So, yeah, we you know.
That's a horrible job. That's the only one I've done in the vineyard and that's the only one I'm ever going to do once.
It's, you know, it's pretty harsh. You know, we're... You know, you're typically pruning in really cold days, sub-zero temperatures, so it can be really hard. But they seem keen to come back and give it a go. So, you know, we've now got a really good group of local pickers. We've got local pruners. We use some gang labor for certain tasks. We've got a bit of planting that's going on next year, and we get some of the people in to help lay out stakes, etc., which is quite tedious and tough work. But generally, we're using local staff, which I'm really pleased about.
Okay, and so they're all getting, it's not like voluntary work, it's a proper paid job, etc.
Yeah, no, they get paid. And they, you know, we hope that, you know, they feel as though they're being looked after. Yeah. And, you know, we had a little harvest lunch at the end of the picking period, and they all seemed to enjoy that. And then we had a group over the middle weekend when we were picking with friends and family who came down. Unfortunately, it was blown off this year because of Storm Brian, which came through. So it was horizontal rain and about 70-mile-an-hour winds, but we had a group of trade pickers who came down as well, so people from the trade, from the industry, who came down for a day. So, yeah, real mixture. They were volunteers. The rest are all being paid. And long may it continue. We're going to need more of them next year, and we're hopeful that you know, we'll be able to do it. I think that there's a very good chance we'll get 200 people from the local area picking next year.
That's good then, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think we have to work at it because, you know, now we're leaving the European Union. There's no certainty over agricultural work permits. I think it's more than likely that they will be renewed and that there will be some sort of scheme available for farmers. Because there are something like 75 or 80,000 people who are working in the agricultural industry from predominantly they're from Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And other parts of Europe, and they're really, really important to the farming industry. But so far, we've been lucky that we've been able to find people from the local area, and long may that continue.
Excellent. All right, then, Mark, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Chris.